My next guest is going to be Myron Cook, and this is a pretty remarkable guy, a Renaissance guy of adventure, I'd call him. He's a sailor. He's a Grand Canyon River boatman extraordinaire way back. Starting in Grand Canyon is where I got to know him, but he has a remarkable experience in skydiving and being a pilot and being a world traveler, and particularly his sailing and expertise in that incredible sport on a global basis. So, have a nice, relaxed seat and sit in on Myron Cook. So, Myron, where did you get born up?
Well, I was born in Syracuse, New York.
And, that's what I thought it was, New York.
Huh? Yeah, but I was only there 6 months or something. My family was, they were kind of passing through. My father was a chemist. And, those are during the war years, 45, and they moved him around.
Now, who was your dad working for?
He worked for a woolen company, and then when the war started, they went on to making rayon for tires. And so it was an American woolen company, and that moved on into the
military. War effort.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people did that. They changed vocation and went after.
Yeah.
And then what got you started with the river is you...
Well,
you
know,
end up
I feel really grateful. I've been just things that come around the corner, just kind of serendipity. And I was going to school in Massachusetts, going to college there, and I started skydiving there at the University of Massachusetts on their collegiate skydiving program, which was just a bunch of ex-military guys having fun. And from there, we entered skydiving competition we were in Massachusetts, but it was going on all over the United States. Every year, there was a national meet. And so I went to Phoenix to participate in the meet. And, on the way to Phoenix, it was the 60s. So we had a really good time driving across the country. There were four of us, one of which was Dick Clark, who was one of the major people he's the guy that actually brought me to the river. I was working out of North Africa on a boat at the time, and he wrote me a note to the port captain in Tangier. Man, that's how you got mail back then. There wasn't any telephone or any kind of thing like that. So said, we got something pretty good going out here. You might want to look into it. So I'd been a couple of years on that boat, working out of North Africa, Mediterranean, that area. Then came back to the States and got an old truck and drove out to Lee's Ferry and met up with Dick. Quite a neat, kind of serendipity kind of thing, but it certainly did work out well. And I had no intention of, when I looked over the rim of Grand Canyon, that 36 years later I would still be running river trips.
Well, and that's why you're sitting here. This is Grand Canyon and all things Grand Canyon. Now, was that when you guys were working for Fort Lee Company? And for the listeners' sake, back in the 70s, there was a company called Fort Lee Expeditions. And it was named after Lee's Ferry, and they actually had a warehouse and the whole outfit was staged right there at Lee's Ferry.
Yeah, we had rental boats there. There was a general store.
There was a little hamburger stand.
And it was open year-round.
Yeah.
And it was pretty neat. I had the opportunity, Dick and I actually were the caretakers of that place for a couple of winters, a couple of full seasons. Just a real... got an opportunity to get away from it all, plus make a little bit of a living. I think we were making $2.50 an hour.
That's a lot of money back then.
Yeah, back in the
70s. Especially for guys that really didn't earn it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, we had issues.
When the warehouse burned down,
yeah.
When your truck was in it,
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that event.
Oh, man. We were downriver. I was actually swamping for Dick back then. I hadn't got my own boat yet. And we were downriver, and we were helicoptering people in from the reservation on a three-day kind of, they call it, they advertised it as a real quick adventure in Grand Canyon. Actually, it was Marble Canyon, but we would helicopter people in off the reservation, then helicopter the three-day people coming down out. And then we had some people going for 8 days. So we offered three different trips. A trip from Lee's Ferry that took 3 days to get to the Little Colorado, and then a trip that went from the Little Colorado down to Lake Mead, Temple Bar in Lake Mead. Or the person who wanted to do the full 8 day trip. We did this all in 8 days, pretty quick. Anyway, there's three different options with the Fort Lee Company, and Tony Sparks, of course, ran that. Neat guy.
Yeah, and now that's when you had that helipad right there at the Confluence.
Yeah, it's still there, you know.
It's still there.
I still go up there and sit there. So we're downriver, and passengers are flying in, and they're going, so there was a big fire at where you live. And we kind of just didn't know what was going on there, but it turned out that there was the Fort Lee Company fire. I had my truck in there. Dick had his truck in there. And, of course, none of us had any insurance. And, I mean, we had all our belongings in those vehicles. My parachute, my mountain bike, all that stuff, you know, it's just gone.
Did they ever get down to how that started?
Well,
was it arson?
I don't know. I couldn't comment on that. Honestly, I don't. I'm not evading the question by any means. It was never anything concrete or anything more than even hearsay about the whole thing. But anyway, it burned to the ground. Man, it was. You went back after that fire, and there was those old Merc 20s, you know, those old lightning bolt Merc 20s.
Oh, yeah, they were
the
best.
They were puddles. Puddles of aluminum. It was a hot fire.
How did your car fare?
Oh, it didn't fare at all. It got completely burned. It was basically a relic. There was no even metal value in the metal. And then, it had to be torn down. And Dean Waterman, one of the guy that had that, the welding place over in Kanab, he got the contract to tear down the aluminum. It was an aluminum structure with a lot of wood in it. But those rubber boats, you know, we had all those brand new 37s that were neoprene that GCE had, you know.
Rubber fabricators.
Yeah, rubber fabricators. But I bet we had six of them, man. We had a good-looking fleet because we'd gone from those kind of cotton boats that were so vulnerable onto a nylon boat. God, what a difference, man.
That was a big transition. For the listener, the boats that we're talking about, the 37s, the 35s, the D-rigs, they were originally pontoons for crossing rivers, for crossing tanks across rivers. The side tubes were for bridging pontoons. But also these donuts, these big, long 37-foot donuts, were for big bridges across big masses of water. And they also used them for floating platforms for whatever operations that they had going along. And so the early pontoons and donuts and stuff that were used for these motor trips that were adapted to river running down there,
Army surplus.
And so they started out, the older ones, the World War II tubes, were made out of cotton fabric impregnated neoprene. And so there was fabric of cotton sandwiched into the neoprene, and they held air real good and stuff, but they weren't very durable as far as if you hit a rock too hard with them or anything sharp. That cotton would puncture. Then I think it was in the Korean War that they started building them out of nylon. And so that surplus material was much, like, 10 times better as far as its durability and its longevity for this sort of use. And just so that's kind of a little clearer to the listener. And I bet it burned really hot in that.
Yeah, in that fire. Yeah, it did. And and Tom Wertman was a ranger back then. Nothing came as far as the arson thing, I think. Nothing.
And Tom will try and get on a session of Big Adventures because he is a fantastic, wonderful human
guy,
being.
Man.
And
yeah,
so
I enjoy
it. We'll get him on one of these. So downriver, so you were working for Fort Lee, and did you do stuff for Hatch back then too, didn't you?
No, really? I flew. I actually was a pilot, so I didn't. And this is when Jack Reynolds was flying for Ted Hatch. No, not so much. Mostly just Fort Lee Company, and then I went on to cross tours after that. After the fire, there was no company anymore, and so we kind of scattered. And I ended up working for John Cross, a wonderful gentleman, a real old river man in his own right, and a guy that did explorations in Mexico. And back in the early days, he's in the early 70s. So
now I've got a very sensitive story for you to tell us about. It's a famous old story. A lot of people, and you're, you
God,
see
you're,
it coming.
It's starting to scare me, man. Yeah.
There's a rapid down there for the listener. There's a real difficult rapid down there called Bedrock Rapid. And it's a place where you really have to make a move to go right. And the river's all going left around this big central huge rock feature right in the middle of the river. And so if you miss it, great consequence there if you miss that cut. Can you share the old story about the boat at Bedrock?
Come on.
I know you're not happy about this.
Oh, no. It was a lot. You know what I'll tell you? You know, a lot of... I was just starting out in the river business. And shoot, like anything, you just... being a neophyte, you're
shooting from the hip.
Yeah, you don't make a lot. Sometimes the decisions aren't as good as they might be, and also you don't have the training to pull a plan B out of your hat. So anyway, we were it was a Fort Lee Company trip, and there were two boats. We were running individual trips. Skip Jones was running another trip at the same time, but we weren't camping together. We just kind of were staying in touch. And I wasn't a guide. I was a swamper, and boatman was Bob Wade, just a neat guy, very talented mountain climber, too, a technical climber and athlete. And we had run all the way down to that mile 130, and he asked me if I wanted to ride. Of course, man, geez, or drive. Shoot, you know, any chance you get a chance to drive.
Oh, yeah, when you're a swamper, and for the listener again, the swamper is kind of that position that's in training. They're the ones that are doing all the work for the lead guide.
Apprentice.
They're an apprentice, they're a trainee, and their whole goal is to become a boatman, generally, when you have that swamper position. But go ahead.
Yeah, most companies are. Some companies actually have professional swampers, but gosh, during the day, you can't imagine that you only go there because you want to run your own rig. You don't go there to be a second boatman or swamper. You go there because you want your own rig. And so I was he handed me the throttle right above Bedrock, and I think probably I certainly didn't realize where we were, and possibly Bob as well, but I cut up running down, and you see all the water goes to the port side and left of this big rock that Brian's talking about, but then there's that kind of looks more like a little bit of a alternative to the right, which is the preferred run, and so I started going left, and Bob looked up and said, "Geez, man, go right or whatever," but it was too late. I mean, I made the boat go right as much as I could with full power. You only got a little 20 horsepower Merc on that, so full cob, nothing. But you got to understand the force of the river is impacting that it's almost like a wall in front of you. And so anyway, the boat got sideways against the rock, against the flood. It was like almost a flat wall. And then the upstream tube started going under. You could see as the force of the water pushed the boat up kind of at an angle, the upriver tube started taking more and more impact of the river, more and more force, and eventually rolled the boat upside down. I mean, that, you know, brand new boat and those two brand new Mercs and all those cots and all that food and all those 12 people got to go for a greater adventure than any of us anticipated.
An eye-opening little swim there. Yeah. Now, talk about big adventures. That's a big adventure.
Yeah. You know, it was, the beauty of it, nobody was really hurt, but I had to get in the water. I really had to figure some stuff out, man. I had to get in the water. I had people that were in an eddy upstream on the river left port side of where we were coming in. I had a woman holding on to a cliff. So somehow I had to get back up river and get above her, swim down to where she was, because she wasn't going to jump in the water to come. There wasn't any way she was going to get rescued. So we got her off the wall, into the water, and we swam back down below bedrock. We went around we actually swam the left side of bedrock. And then most of the passengers and the gear floated down river right, which was a preferred run, although it was less water, it's a preferred run. And the boat went left. Actually, the boat went left around the rock in the main flow.
So it came off after it flipped.
Huh?
It came off on its own accord?
Off because it was so far left, so far in the wrong position. I mean, 20/20 hindsight, I mean, boats have run left there and survived. But, you know, shoot, man, this is...
You're the swamper, and you're told go to the right. You know?
Well, no, not told anything. You're just there reading it.
Yeah.
So anyway, the boat went around to the left side of the rock and landed upside down, perched up on an angle on some bedrock. That's why they call it bedrock. and then that's the boat was upside down, and the Fourth River was holding it on that. On that pitch, on that inclined plane around on the left side. And anyway, we ended up, there were boats behind us. Skip Jones, wonderful man, came by and started collecting up people and gear. There was a guy, he's a, God, escapes my name. Bill Latimer.
Bill Latimer, yeah.
And Bill Latimer, a few boats went by and thought, oh, well, perhaps that's not we don't really want to get into that mess. Or they were on a tight schedule. But Latimer stopped and got lines on my boat that was upside down with his people. I mean, he pulled me off that rock.
He was the hero, man.
Yeah, well, he's always been a
hero.
A uphill guy, you know.
Yeah.
Upstanding guy. Anyway, we went downriver and we got food and gear and stuff from other river parties and continued our trip.
and
yeah.
Sometimes on these big boats, they weren't rigged for the flip, and so you lost a lot of gear.
Well, we lost all our gear. You know, in Fort Lee, we had generators. We were at that time making $55 a day, which was outrageous. That was huge money.
Yeah, that was big money back then.
Back in the 70s, $55 money. Oh, Lord. I mean, I went, after Fort Lee Company, I went to work for $30 a day running lead for Cross Tours.
Now, so then you were with Cross for quite a while, weren't
you? Yeah.
You had Pete and Duffy and Dick and Ma. How long were you with those guys?
Oh,
Cross Tours.
God, that's I'd have to look it up, but God, it'd be a shot from the hip to say 5 years or more than 5 years. And John Cross was he was one of the original people that put river trips together, and several people from Utah were outfitters because they ran trips for Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scout. Then they ended up with equipment and boats, and then all at once it became, you had to get a permit. So those people who had historic usage in Grand Canyon, and it was Glen Canyon too. A lot of these guys ran up in Glen Canyon. Ken Slidehead, his own company, Slight Expeditions, and
Georgie White
and Ted Hatch. They all had kind of a little. I think Hatch had a Boy Scout connection, but pretty much a large percentage had historically ran scout trips and then went on to become commercial.
Yeah, a bunch runners. Of the stuff up in Glen Canyon, as I recall, was Boy Scouts. Big use of Boy Scouts from all over the place.
It was fun to hear, and that's where Moki Mack came. And Moki, who we called Moki, is last name was Elworth, and he's the gentleman who was one of the main figures in the earlier company called Moki Mack. It was interesting how that all came up. And then Glen Canyon was kind of the quiet, more family-oriented canyon compared to Grand Canyon. That was kind of had more, rapids, and it was pretty longer trips, more rapids, and less forgiving, you might say, for
making a mistake. Yeah, than Glen Canyon, you bet. Now, moving on, as far as, I'm real curious as to your skydiving. You've done a tremendous amount. How many dives have you got? How many times?
Over 1,000. I got over 1,000 skydives, and it's been fun. I went to the University of Massachusetts, and I ran into a guide there, Dick Clark, who I mentioned here previously, who I met when I was in school, and we actually lived lived off campus in kind of the same. It was an old house that had rented rooms. I mean, $6 a week kind of thing. Anyway, and Dick was just getting out of the military. I was actually I was kind of a farm boy. Had not done a lot of stuff as far as adventures, other than just traveling around with my parents and stuff. Anyway, I ran into Dick, and Dick was skydiving, and I was running up. I was actually working in ballet and modern dance. God, I don't tell that to many people. Don't tell that to any of my buddies that I ride motorcycles with.
Everybody that's listening, we'll keep that a secret.
Yeah. Anyway, so I was doing choreography for dancing and stuff in this place where we were living, and God had all these all these ballet and dance, you know, really nice girls and interesting people coming and going out of my place, and then I got to know Dick, and Dick says, you know what, you got to make a skydive. Anyway, he didn't teach me personally, but I ended up going out with him to a place called Turner's Falls, Massachusetts, which is it's a little DZ, a little drop zone out in western Massachusetts. And they had a little 182 with no door on it. And shoot, we did a course, skydive, learn how to skydive, man. You got a static line, and you do 5 static lines with a dummy ripcord pull, and you go out of the plane, and you have a static line attached to the plane, but you have a ripcord in your harness, and it has a flag on it so that the instructor can look out of the door and see that if the ripcord didn't pull, static line didn't pull your canopy out of your pack, you could have pulled. So you do 5 of those. Then you cleared for a free fall. And so now, man, you're free, man. You go out of that door with a parachute in your back, and you're in charge. You're dead until you do something. Yeah, it's good. I've been skydiving for 40 years or more, and pretty much all over the world doing stuff.
Now, you've been involved with some of these formation attempts, these record formations.
Yeah.
What is the record formation now?
They've
gotten just ridiculous.
It's hundreds. It's hundreds. It's like, I don't know. Gosh, it must be over. It's well over 200. People that go out, and there's a guy, the king of Thailand loves skydivers. And of course, he's got this whole military at his fingertips, and he is putting together and has historically put together these big C-130s and all these formations for the skydivers from all over the world. They're kind of collected around in the U.S., but all over the world to get together and make these huge record attempts from above 20,000 feet. You got to be in oxygen to go up, and they've done a great job with it. I was in the 30-way. I got a 30-way formation I did here in Salt Lake, actually outside Salt Lake, a place called Turner's Falls. We all got together, had 2 DC-3s and a couple of airplanes, and did a 30-way, which has been far surpassed. That's
But that was a record at the time,
wasn't
it?
At the time, yeah, yeah. Cool pictures, man. I got a picture or two on my wall. I just kind of keep reminding myself, yeah, okay, I did that. It's by now.
So it must be a tremendous feeling to really do the relative flying to get into a hitched up position with the formation
sure.
and stuff. Then what happens when you're done and it's official, you did the formation?
Yeah.
The back guys peel out. How do you diss him?
Well, you're the last guys in or the first guys out. Obviously, they're on the outside of the star, outside of the formation, so they peel off, and they might peel off a couple thousand feet above the internal formation, and it just kind of weeds itself out, and it gets smaller and smaller with the outside people peeling off. You do a turn off. And you track, and the track position is a position that has your shoulders rolled forward, your arms at your side, your arms your hands cupped, your toes pointed, your legs together, and you are at an angle to the earth where you're starting to pick up a little bit of air friction on your chest and legs, so you can be like a projectile away from the other skydivers, which are doing the same thing. They're all, and you're looking. It's all SA, situational awareness. And you're aware of where the other skydivers are that are tracking off, and you get your opening altitude, and you look above you, you turn and you look above you, make sure there's nobody over your head because you don't want to dump into their face or above. You know, if you got somebody above you, you don't want to open a canopy in their area, and then you give a wave off, which is you take your arms and you just wave off, and you see somebody waving off, you know that pretty soon there's something going to come off their back.
Yeah, and they're dumping their cameras.
Yeah. And so anyway, it's pretty self. Skydiving is pretty methodical. People maybe think that it's crazy, but you know, it's really well thought out, and even more so today. I mean, we're talking some of this stuff is we were jumping. Just like our river gear, we were jumping Army surplus stuff, round canopies, and then they went to square canopies and different wings, and you know it's been greatly enhanced the safety of the skydiving sport, as well as they have automatic openers. If you get knocked out in a free fall or somebody hits you, you got a automatic opener AOD on your back with fires with a 22 caliber. A cartridge fires a opening on your reserve, so even if you're unconscious, your reserve will get out, and your lifeless body will crash to the ground under a smaller canopy, but at least you'll probably save your life.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that must be... When was the last time you...
I haven't jumped 5 years. About 5 years ago, I stopped doing it. I got... You know, shoot, man, I got other things I want to do, and you know, just a little few things, opening shock, and a couple other things that kind of aggravate your neck and your back. You know, it was a kind of a hard call. I'm not running rivers so much anymore. I mean, I do private trips and from time to time, and I enjoy that, but I don't have the focus or the energy now to punch out trips. You know, sit up the head, set up the galley, row all day in the wind. You know, I'm going to leave that for the younger guys. And they're sure doing a great job. A lot of younger boatmen are stars.
And then, but I do understand that you're still paragliding.
Paraglide, yeah, yeah. I kind of got into paragliding. That's it's a little different. They say paragliding is like foreplay and skydiving is like the orgasm. And that might be pretty true, but it's nice to get your feet off the ground.
And there's some pretty good launch zones here, right?
Oh, yeah. Utah.
Off the Wasatch?
Well, they are off. There's a lot of them all over the world now. It's really popular. The reason paragliding is more popular is you don't have to carry a big tube with a rigid wing. A hang glider is a rigid, and it needs structure, and you have to carry that around with you, and it takes quite a bit of equipment compared to paraglider, which is the size of a large parachute that you can just throw in your trunk, and it's easy to transport.
Is there a safety difference as far as
hang gliding and paragliding?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a little more forgiving than
paragliding's a little more forgiving, although you can get a collapse. The big thing is you get a part of your wing. Your paragliding leg, because it's not rigid, is subject to asymmetrical collapse. So one side can get collapsed or turned under, and then immediately puts you into a spin, and if you don't stop it quickly, you get pretty violent to where it's even hard to lift your arms up because of the centrifugal force. Yeah.
Wild.
So starting off, you gotta do it right the first time. I mean, you can't drive that thing into the ground. I've hang glided up in Canada a few times, and I really liked it. But anyway, I was skydiving back then, and then I just went on to flying a paraglider.
Well, it keeps you interested in the stuff. And then what got you into the sailing originally?
I was a bartender on Cape Cod, and working this bar called the Harbor Lounge in Falmouth, and it was right next to a marina. And one of my customers that would come in frequently, his name was John Taylor, another guy that military, he ran an admiral's rig in the Navy. And so anyway, he was out of the Navy, and he was running a yacht for this wealthy company. He was running he had a beautiful Trumpy, what's called a Trumpy, which actually had belonged to Rita Hayworth back in the day. It was a beautiful boat. And I got to know him real well, and he goes, you know, you maybe want to try running a yacht. And I was just getting out of college, and in fact, I was graduating there in January of 70, this was. He says, come on down to Florida. And he says, I'll put you to work on my boat. And God, this guy was a wonderful guy, still is. And so I ended up driving down to Florida, catching up with John, and started working with him running that boat out to the Bahamas. Yeah, so we did that, and I wanted to get to Europe. And I was just graduated from college, and I had $1,000 in my pocket, more money than I could imagine ever having. Wow, $1,000. Anyway, I didn't want to spend it going to Europe on an airplane, so I was looking for boats to get to Europe. I was hanging out down in the marinas looking for boats that were doing the transatlantic. Living on the Sea Princess, which was John's boat, and every day going to around the docks and the dock boys and seeing if I could find a boat going to get me to the Azores and Gibraltar. And so, one of the dock boys said, hey, you know, I know you're looking for a rig. A guy just pulled in, man. He fired his engineer. He's headed for Europe in a couple months. And I said, yeah, okay. So I went and talked to the guy, and that's kind of an interesting story, too. So I went, this guy's name was Charlie Conlon, and he had a boat called Limmershin. It was a 56-foot ferro cement catch. Understand, ferro cement. Ferro is cement. It's a boat made out of concrete. And this thing was beautiful, just absolutely beautiful. It was a yacht of the year on Sail Magazine in 1970. A remarkable boat. And he needed an engineer. He was a hell of a sailor, but he was an engineer. He needed an engineer. And I was I portrayed myself as a diesel mechanic. Hell, I'd grown up on a farm, and man, I knew a lot about diesel tractors and diesel equipment, man. We used all our John Deere's were diesel but I had a little kind of long hair and stuff. And so he said, I don't know, come on back maybe another day or something. But I went home and I went and got a haircut, a short haircut, man, put on a tan flight uniform or, you know, shirt, went back to talk to him again. And he goes, well, anyway, I ended up getting the job with him. And so I sailed in November of 1970. I went on board Limmershin as engineer, chief engineer, I don't know, 4 or 5 days to Bermuda. And then crossing was 2 weeks to the Azores and then into Gibraltar. And we did everything celestial, man. We were doing sun. There was no GPS. There was no DECA. There was no Loran. It was all sun sights.
Wow.
And celestial navigation.
Call you old fashioned.
Yeah. 25 days later, we pulled into Gibraltar. You know, you get pretty tight on a boat. There were 5 of us on the boat. I was the only maybe loose cannon, you might say. The other people were all friends with one another, and they were all pretty prestigious people on that boat, doctors and and so forth, professional people. And then, but we did have a professional navigator on board who was part of the yacht club that Limmershin was in. A very cool guy. And he taught me most of what I learned about celestial navigation so that we could go on and navigate without him. That was certainly a gift.
Yeah, you bet. That's serendipitous things.
Yeah, yeah, so I use that a lot. So we pull into Spain. We're coming into Spain, and we go to a place called Jose Banus, which is one of the, this is, you know, we're talking 45 years ago. Anyway, so this was a lot of yacht harbors. Came into Jose Banus, and the owner told, okay, everybody off the boat, and God, some of these people thought they were just going to live in Spain and live on that boat for a while, maybe a week or two. And he goes, no, my wife and daughter are flying in. And everyone just get off the boat. It was kind of a, you know, some people were tired of seeing other people after 25 days at sea. Me, I didn't care one way or another. I'm just a loose cannon and doing my job as engineer. And that was, some of that was fun. Some of the stuff I did on that boat was definitely shooting from the hip, fixing stuff. And it was the boat had just come out of the yard. It hadn't even basically had sea trials. It was a new boat. So there was a lot of mechanics to get figured out.
Smooth out.
So anybody left the boat, I grabbed my sea bag. Shoot, man, I was in Europe. I still had the $1,000 in my pocket. And here I was in Europe. And so I'm way ahead of the game. And so I'm walking off the boat, and Charlie goes, where are you going? I go, well, man, I'm done. You know, I appreciate the trip, and it was great knowing you. And he said, well, what's your plan? And I said, well, I don't have a plan, except I'm in Europe, and I'll wing it. He said, don't make any commitments until you talk to me again. And because I was going off to stay in back then it was just kind of a youth hostel. You know, they were cheap, just a couple bucks a night. And we were in Jose Banus. So, and I headed up to Barcelona, which is where I kind of wanted to be to start my trip. And so anyway, I did actually come up to Barcelona, and they took the boat up. Charlie and his family took the boat from Jose Banus up to Barcelona. And so I met, you know, I was in Barcelona for a few days, met a really neat gal that I was traveling with at the Swedish gal, Pietra from Sweden. So I said, hey, I'm going to go to Sweden with you. That was good. We figured that out right away. But I said, we got to go down and talk to this guy, because I told him I wouldn't make any plans until I talked to him. So Pietra and I went back down to the Limmershin in the yacht harbor, and you know, I told Charlie that you know, I was thinking about heading for Sweden, and I said, what's your deal? Give me your best shot. Give me what you got. And he said, well, I'll pay you $50 a week. You get the full run of the cruise quarters. You'll see Europe with me like you will never see with anybody else. I mean, we were going to see the Eisenhowers and Princess Grace and Prince Rainier and Monaco. I mean, they had quite the high-end trips planned. I mean, these are way high-end people. And he said, and you'll see Europe like nobody else would. And he says, and she can come. And so, God, Pietro and I go, well, okay.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that was going to be that was very generous. Of course, this guy, you got to realize this guy Charlie, who's a wonderful man. He just he was taking care of me like a son from the time he figured out I was okay to till for 20, 50, 30 years later. We were still connected.
Well, that's what it's about, isn't it?
This
relationships that you gain from good adventures and good
so here I was, 1970, making $50 a week, which was,
and you still have $1,000 in your pocket.
Yeah, and I still have $1,000 in my pocket, right?
You know, on a serious note, we're kind of running out of time, but I want to ask you about your optimism for the future. As far as, look at what adventure, how that has affected your life, and it's obvious that you've lived one adventure after another, and the great outdoors, the sea, the sky, all impressive, integral, intimate things to you. How are we looking in the future? You know, when you look at where we're at right now as far as how things are being removed environmentally, as far as protection and the way that society is as far as its growth aspect, as far as how we're taking care of our fragile little planet here. What's your take on our future as far as the human
being? Well, I'd say it's a little bit scary. It's way scary. I don't have kids, so I'm more afraid for my family and my friends that have children or whatever. But we've really managed to rape and take a lot out of Mother Earth. I was just down in the West Indies running a charter, and I had the opportunity to spend a day kind of with another pal of mine on a beach down there, and kind of the trade winds are blowing. I'm just standing on this beach, and you know, and the ocean was talking to me. Man, and she goes, "I'm hurting." You know, Mother Nature's really hurting.
Yeah. Well,
it's my prayer that we figure it out, but
it's looking pretty tough, isn't it?
Yeah, but and I'm an optimist. I'm a habitual optimist. I just figure, man, it'll work out. You know, they'll figure it out. But you know what? The optimism will take you so far. I'm not going to let it make my days sad or hard or whatever. But it's time to try to make a move. And a lot going on, global warming, and we're seeing it every day down in the Caribbean where the coral reefs are dying. I mean, I saw more death of the reefs this last trip. The tops are all white from too much. They're not reproducing. The tops of the brain coral is white. And this is just in the last couple of years.
Yeah, so it's damn scary.
Yeah, I just hope that we can figure it out.
Well, you know, that's what I love about you. And our relationship has always been about these things and about our own mutual medicine and stuff. And I love that about you. And thank you for your time with me here. And I look forward to another visit down the chain here. But I really appreciate your passion for life and your love for Mother Earth. And like I say, you and I, we got medicine.
Yeah, we've had a really good time. You know what? And we got a lot around the corner. I mean, as soon as I hear your voice on the phone or see you, I just start to giggle a little bit. I go, I guess there's going to be some smiles and laughter and good times coming soon.
So many people are completely shielded from honesty like that.
Yeah.
And I love you for it.
Yeah, man. Hey, take care of yourself, Brian. Good to see you, pal.
I love you, man.
All right, man.
So, boy, I can't get enough of those stories. Myron's, like I said, the renaissance of adventure. Really enjoyed that. And, you know, you got to get out there and adventure, and I think he's an inspiration to that. So have a nice evening. Thanks for sitting in, and stay right side up.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Buchner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.